BBC Six Music podcasts.
Six Music.
This is a free download from the BBC.
Find out more at bbc.co.uk/sixmusic.
And now, Adam and Joe.
Good evening, good afternoon, or whatever time it is that you're listening to this podcast from the BBC. My name's Adam Buxton.
I'm Joe Cornish.
We're the presenters of this programme, which goes out on a Saturday morning at 10 a.m. until 1 in the p.m. on Six Music. It's a digital station.
The programme you're about to hear is immature, adolescent and disappointing.
It contains a certain amount of fascination with farting and toilet areas.
For two men in their early 40s, some of the things that we say and do are frankly pathetic.
Pathetic and pointless, and not in any way advancing the cause of things that are important or matter.
But we hope you think it's Wigglesticks.
So please enjoy the following podcast as much as you possibly can. If you have any complaints, keep them to yourself!
Hey, you! That's right, you! What the heck do you think you're doing, friend? Sitting and worrying, the world's about to end. When there's a brand new podcast about to start, I'm foreign, hooray! Adam and Joe are here to make things right. Their inconsequential chatter will illuminate your night. Your spirits will be lifted, your problems will be solved. Unless they're really serious, then we just can't get involved. We took the live show and then we chopped it up and put the little pieces in the special podcast cup. Prepare to drink from it, share some with your cat. It's like a great big noodle pot prepared with yummy chat.
Did you ever have a punk phase, Joseph Cornish?
Not really, no. No, I was a bit too young for punk. That was during the Silver Jubilee and stuff. I was being very patriotic and monarchistic and wearing lots of Union Jack badges and going to street parties.
Same here. I was
certainly was not being a punk.
I wasn't jumping about being rude about the Queen. Why would I want to do that? Why be any different? I was enjoying my Jubilee mug, which I still have on the shelf, along with my Charles and Di.
Well, you've got a very big collection of royal memorabilia.
Sure I do.
The listeners would be surprised if they walked into your front room. It's completely decked out with Union Jacks, Kate and Wills, Fergie and what's-his-face, and Charles and Di stuff.
Yeah.
Jubilee, Golden Jubilee, Queen Mum. You love them.
Absolutely love them. Can't get enough of them. Laura, memorabilia.
You're royalty obsessed.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of the royal family as we were just then, I found myself in a strange position the other day. I was round for lunch at someone's house and they had that book of photographs where they've got doubles for the royal family.
Yeah.
And they're taking pictures of them in shocking positions and stuff, doing naughty things. What's the name of that lady who does those?
Oh. Alison.
Yeah.
I've got a mug by her.
It's an Alison. And anyway, they were flicking through that, and one of the pictures was, and everyone was kind of passing the book round and chuckling at it and stuff. And one of the pictures.
It sounds like a marvellous dinner party.
Well, it was, you know, it was one of those things where, I don't know if you, I'm sure you do get this actually, Joe, but everyone is getting so into something and enjoying it so much, you think, I'm going to rain on this parade.
You're talking to scornballs.
Exactly.
What do you mean? That's my MO.
That's right. I'm going to think, what would Joe do? I know, he'd get a little bucket of scorn. He'd pour it on that book.
That's not what I do.
So I thought, I'm going to do that too. So I got out my scorn bucket. And when the book came round to me, I found this. One of the photographs was they'd mocked up the doubles of Wills and Kate out in Africa. And Wills and Kate were wandering along hand in hand in their nice clothing, looking happy. And in the background, there were loads of African people, like tribes people dressed up in tribal gear, carrying Wills and Kate's luggage, you know,
right.
Like loads and loads of their luggage. And
I get it.
And looking sort of exhausted. And I just thought that is beyond the pale, because I don't think Wills and Kate would do that. I don't think that they would walk along there and let someone else carry their luggage in that way, whether they were in Africa or any other part of the world. And I felt like what started out being a bit of scorn pouring ended up being just me defending the royal family against accusations.
And it's happening again.
In a way it is, because I'm broadcasting it, aren't I? On a radio program. I forgot about that.
Adam and Joe. Adam and Joe. Adam and Joe, the podcast. Adam and Joe,
touch me.
Adam and Joe,
no,
Adam and Joe,
Listen, it's Retro Text the Nation time. Retro Text the Nation. Were you ready for that?
Yeah. I was just going to do another.
Oh, well, don't. No, go on to. Okay. It's Retro Text the Nation time. This is the time when people who listen to the show via the podcast or via Listen Again can contribute to the previous week's Text the Nation, if that's clear. That's why it's called Retro Text the Nation. And of course, just to be serious for a moment, this section of the show does have one of the most incredible jingles ever. No, hang on, I think it's actually the most amazing jingle ever written. And I wrote it, and when I wrote it, I did write it. When I wrote it, I just had no idea.
Yeah.
I had no idea. I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, I had no idea I was writing the greatest jingle, but you don't. And I was talking to Sir Paul McCartney the other day, and I was asking him whether he knew when he wrote some of those songs that they were what they were, and he said no, and that's, you know, and I said no. I said it's amazing because I didn't feel it either, and we got on really well.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm
you popping. He was talking about yesterday, and you were saying, well, yes, Retro Text the Nation is the yesterday of jingles.
That is, but he brought it up. There's no way I would have started that conversation, sure. But he brought it up.
It's the most covered jingle, I'm sorry to say. Mm. Here is a message from Nicholas Cecil Montgomery Ward III, mailman.
Yes, he's very clever.
From Chelmsford in Essex.
Perceptive man.
He says, Dear Professor Buxopheles and Dr. Cornucopia, my friend David works as an archivist at the Big British Castle, and he's recently discovered a remarkable and previously unheard demo recording of the Beatles from 1962, talking about Macca. However, I feel that this startling discovery may help to redress the animosity felt by Adam around the ongoing popularity of the Retro Text the Nation jingle. Well, let's have a listen and see what he's on about.
I used to listen to Adam and Joe, but I listened to the podcast and not the live show. I used to feel acute frustration, yeah.
Oh no!
Oh yeah! Because I couldn't join in with Text the Nation, but now my problems have disappeared.
Because Retro Text the Nation's here.
But now I let him admit it off instead of throwing the bin.
I mean, that's very amusing, but that's not the Beatles.
Is it not?
No, that's fake. I mean, because I just wouldn't want you to diminish my true story about meeting Paul McCartney and us chatting with some bit of fakery. I mean, it's very good fake. Well done.
Well done, Nicholas.
That's beautiful.
Nicholas Ward, thank you so much for that. Although, you know, I don't think the Beatles ever did have a phase where they sang in broad Liverpudlian accents. I'm not sure about that. A Beatles expert could tell me. But let's get into Retro Text the Nation. Last week, we were talking about domestic decoration differences, the triple D, that divides so many happy households. You're in there, you're cohabiting with your partner or your wife or whoever you're cohabiting with. And
what is going on this morning?
I don't know.
It's like, no, that's what I call DJ voices. We've had everyone from your dad through to some kind of Radio 1 DJ. Now what are we? Hospital radio.
I don't know. I'm someone who says yeah instead of your. I'm your kind of daytime, your fun DJ. Your DJ who says yeah in front of a lot of your things. So domestic decorating differences.
In front of a lot of your things.
Yeah. You know, it's when you have a massive argument with your partner about how you're going to decorate your house. Is that clear enough?
Yes.
Here we go. I'll start you off with one. Here's one from Affy. He's a mailman. Dear Buckles and Corn Nuts, some time ago I mentioned to an old lady friend that having recently used the bathroom at my parents' house, which is carpeted, I found it very cozy, and I would like to have a carpeted bathroom myself in the next place I lived. She found the idea appalling and unhygienic, claiming that bath water would spill out onto the carpet and that men often miss the bowl when urinating. I told her that this was nonsense. Nonsense! Nonsense! And that I never missed the bowl whilst sober or otherwise, and she had been influenced influenced by television into believing that this was a common occurrence. I also told her that at any rate you can put down mats around the toilet or bath, which can then be washed. But she wouldn't budge. She even told me that it would be a deal breaker if we moved in together. Mm-hmm. I found her vehement reaction quite surprising, so took to asking people I know about their feelings on the carpet in the bathroom. To my surprise, no one backed me, and everyone agreed with her that bathroom carpeting is not a good idea, leaving me feeling isolated and unsure of myself. Is there something wrong with me?
Yes.
You're not going for the carpeting in the bathroom?
No.
No, who would? You'd have
who
to be
would?
Mental.
You want a wipe clean surface.
Of course you do.
You don't want a spongy surface that can absorb liquids and hairs.
And munch.
What?
That's one of your words, isn't it?
No, it certainly isn't. So he's on his own. But listen, don't feel isolated. What's his name?
Afi.
Afi, I'm sure there's a stinky woman out there for you. Here's one from Megan from Australia.
Oh, mate.
Dear Adam and Joe. That's good, isn't it?
Where's nice, the nice accent, mate?
Well, I'm not... Shall I read that?
No, you don't have to. Okay. It's disrespectful.
My friend recently moved out with her boyfriend into a new apartment. All right, I'm going to do it. My friend recently moved out with her boyfriend into a new apartment. The place didn't come with curtains, so her boyfriend decided to hang his many football scarves over the windows. He thought it looked so good that they should stay there permanently so they wouldn't need to buy curtains.
Mate.
Good, great idea. Football scarves,
nice
backlit.
Nice idea, mate.
Lovely. This obviously caused an argument, which my friend somehow lost when the plumber came over and said it looked awesome. It's absolutely hideous. Lots of love from Megan.
Megan, why is the plumber settling the arguments?
Well, because he's a plumber.
Right.
He has very earthy skills.
Yeah, you need an objective eye sometimes.
Exactly.
But you can't have the argument settled by someone who doesn't even live in the place.
Football scarves for curtains? That sounds atrocious. They're sort of... they'd be illuminated on a sunny day.
Yeah, that's an absolutely rotten idea.
It is.
Here is a message right now from Andy in Cheltenham. Hey, Andy, how you doing? He says, hello, Captain Buckinghamshire and Lord Cornwallium. I work for one of the UK's largest building societies, and a few years back, they had an advertising campaign. I was forcibly selected as the staff member to star in this campaign, which consisted of my massive head and shoulders and face taking up a whole poster with the tagline, come in and talk to me about savings. This was shown around the whole branch network, and my face was on nearly every high street in the south of England. It's long over now, and I managed to swipe a few of the massive posters, but my fiancé will not let me put up the poster as the main centrepiece of the wall in our living room. I insist on putting it up when we have friends and family round. But you have to understand, this is in a self-mocking, postmodern, ironic style, and definitely not a vanity thing. It collects dust now behind the sofa, and whenever it comes out, I get a look as if to say, put that up and I will surgically remove your cornballs. Please, will you tell my fiancé that this is a healthy and perfectly fine object to display in the living room to settle all future disputes? We're getting married in 2 weeks. This needs to be settled before the marriage can take place, in my opinion. Love you, bye! I mean, he's got a giant poster of himself. Surely you're allowed that in the front room.
I would allow that. Not everybody has a giant poster of themselves.
Well, exactly.
So there you go. We've decreed that he's right. He's allowed to have it.
You know, come and talk to me about savings. Certainly I will. I mean, that's great. Okay? So I would say to your soon-to-be lady wife, Andy, deal with it!
Some of my favourites are people who have huge, awful objects in their houses that their partners can't live with. For instance, David. He sent us a picture of his barbecue. And to describe his barbecue, he's got kind of fake skulls, human skulls.
Plaster skulls.
Plaster skulls. He's piled them up as if some terrible atrocity has happened and poured concrete over them. Very thick concrete. It's a sort of a goth barbecue.
Yes.
Almost like a sacrificial altar.
It's a little like something they would have had in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Yes. And David says, dear Adam and Joe, here's a picture of my barbecue. It's made of human skulls. Brackets, not real. My wife doesn't really like it. I made it while she was away. It's made of concrete. It's totally indestructible and immovable. And we don't have friends round for barbecues anymore. I love you, David. Kiss, kiss, kiss.
Oh, imagine the surprise his wife got when she...
I think that's the key is, if you're going to have a controversial object in your house... Install it while your partner's away and pour concrete over it.
Yeah.
Make sure it's fused to the ground with thick concrete.
Do you think that when she got back, he immediately said, hey, come and look at this? Or do you think he thought, I'm going to be in trouble. I won't mention it. just yet. I'll wait for her to find it. I mean, either way, it would have gone badly.
I'd like to go for a barbecue at David's house. Imagine the nudity. And,
well, it would be good if he did the barbecue sort of stripped to the waist with his body oiled. You know what I mean? A bit like the guy in the pirate anti-piracy commercial.
Yes.
Who's in his...
Yeah, and once you'd had forge. Your allocated hot dog, you would be branded with a small symbol on your forehead.
Yeah.
So you couldn't have seconds.
That's right. We got a message from Emma Bromley. She says, "Dear Adam and Joe, keeping it straight and formal."
Good.
Yeah. Every now and again, that's nice just to be
it's refreshing.
A bit refreshing and respectful. A few years ago, my husband got drunk and bought a three-foot-high stuffed beaver, which now stands in our front room. Now, you can look at this. You can look at our beaver on Twitter at BBC Adam and Joe is our Twitter address. She continues, "I have tolerated it for a number of years, but now we have children, I feel it has become a bit of a health hazard, especially the pointy claws that are just about toddler eye height. I'm formulating a plan to banish it to the loft, where it'll join the set of Queen Russian dolls." That is the band Queen. Set of Russian dolls of Queen. Goodness sake. "The enormous letter M from a shop front, which is also up there, and the framed signed photograph from Nigel from EastEnders, which mysteriously never got unpacked when we moved houses. Kisses, Emma Bromley." And she says, by the way, the beaver cost £1,000.
Wow.
You have got to be steamed out of your mind to pay £1,000 for a big stuffed beaver, surely. And they've got a little fez on there as well, nice little hat on the beaver. But as I say, you can check out a photograph of the beaver in its full glory on our Twitter.
I can see what what's being said there. You don't want a stuffed creature with very sharp claws at toddler eye height.
No.
Do you really?
Absolutely.
I mean,
not.
That's asking for trouble.
Sure it is.
But at the same time, it is wearing a fez.
Yeah.
So I can see the quandary.
It's a little fun fella with a fez.
It's a fun fella. Bit of dangerous, edgy fun around the house.
Hey, have a word. Here's a message from David Doll. We had a couple of messages on this subject. Also got a message from Chris. Thanks for that, Chris. But I'm going to read out David's message. "Dear Buckwheat and Cornucopia Balls, I was recently sitting down catching up on my podcasts and started listening to the Desert Island Discs, Your Desert Island Discs special. It went out on Saturday, the 11th of June, last weekend. It was a very enjoyable and only slightly tedious rundown of listeners' favourite discs for nearly 2 hours. Special studio guests were Miranda Sawyer, Paul Gambaccinoid," he says, "and Howard Goodall. During the opening preamble, Howard and Gambo talk about their Beatles choices. Listen carefully to this clip where Gambo seems to vent his opinion of Howard's Beatles choice with a clearly audible airborne toxic event. 'It must be Gambo,' he says, as it comes from the left speaker where Gambo is positioned. In case you hadn't... In case you can't find said podcast, I've sent you a clip, 'Dirty Gambo,' he says. Thanks very much, David Doll." Now, I immediately heard this clip. It is a very audible airborne toxic event. And the first thing I did was go and verify it, listen to the podcast and make sure that it was actually the show that was broadcast and not just a noise that he'd stuck in for his own amusement. Have a listen to this clip.
Because John Peel had said that he knew he'd met the right woman when she said her favorite track off Revolver was "And Your Bird Can Sing." And I thought, a lovely thought, and it cheers me up. But now I would just say, "Hey, Jude."
After all that, Howard, you chose a Beatles track. You chose "We Can Work It Out."
Yes, yeah. I chose that because it's one of the tracks that Lennon and McCartney truly wrote together, which is quite rare, in fact, in the Beatles catalogue. And because the idea of working it out seemed very British.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's quite a loud,
very loud, isn't
toxic
it?
Event, isn't it? And I've done nothing to that clip. I haven't like beefed up the sound of that or anything. That is how it was broadcast. 100%.
Creaky chair.
Creaky chair. Have a little listen, because we got in touch with the we got in touch with Miranda Sawyer, who was on the show, and she doesn't remember it happening. So she, you know, people in the studio weren't aware of it at the time. Sarah Taylor, who is the Desert Island Discs producer, says, "I am 100% convinced the sound, rather than being from a bottom, is in fact a mouth snort from Paul Gambaccini."
Gambaccini mouth snort.
Gambaccini mouth snort. So that's what Sarah is going for.
Let's listen again.
Let's have another little listen.
it's one of the tracks that Lennon and McCartney truly wrote together, which is quite rare.
That's not a mouth.
That's not a mouth snort.
That is no way a mouth snort. Now I was listening to the
Can't
panning though, and
this is like the Patterson footage of Bigfoot. You've got to try and replicate it.
Or the Zapruder footage,
isn't
know?
It?
You've got I'm thinking the only possible explanation is maybe a fifth farter. You know,
on the grassy knoll. Yeah, I mean it's very loud, which is, you know, I kind of think that's a bit anomalous. Why is it so loud if it's, as you know, further away from the mic as the posterior is?
This is exactly what the Desert Island Discs team was saying. You know, they were saying, well, it's not going to be a nether regions toxic event because there's no mics down there. So how are you going to get that?
Could be a mic stand.
No. One more listen, James. That is not a mic stand. That is no way a mic stand. That
is one of the tracks that Lennon and McCartney truly wrote together, which is quite rare.
I mean, wow. That's terrible, though, because
could it be, it might
that was a big show. It was the big anniversary show, wasn't it? And it's an important show. How could that be?
Yeah.
I mean, that, do you think if that Gambuccini? Wow, I think we should give that footage to Monster Fart Quest or Unexplained Fart Stories.
I think Oliver Stone is making a film about it.
Is he?
Yeah, trying to figure out who it was. His theory is that it's a fifth farter, but
really?
A lot of people think it's Gambo.
Yeah.
I just don't think Gambo's too professional for that kind of thing. I mean, there is a chance that it was just some creepy...
Should I tell you what it is? I think they were all laughing a bit earlier, weren't they?
Yeah.
And that they became relaxed.
Yeah,
everyone was a bit too relaxed and, you know, just the inevitable happened.
Toxic event time.
Great times, great friends, great highlights. The Adam and Joe's Six Music Podcast. It's what extreme boredom was made for. Excuse me.
So listen, folks, I think it's time we had some egg corns, don't you? Because people continue to send these in to the extent that I have created a new jingle. That's always a fun thing, isn't it? Because it officially becomes a segment. Even though this is our last studio-bound show for this current run of the programme, we're going to be in Glastonbury next weekend, of course, I thought it would be nice to get this in here to make it an official egg corn compartment. So here we go with the new jingle.
Somebody's been eardropping on me, and now I'm suffering their strings and arrows, can't you see? I was standing on the curve like a jester of goodwill, but now I'm curled up in the feeble position still, cause of my egg-corns. When it comes to egg-corn business, egg-corns, I'm like farmer hecking Christmas, egg-corns. The pot will call the kettle back, egg-corns, cause it's an egg-corn attack.
Got some egg corns incorporated in the lyrics.
Very
there.
Good.
And you remember we were talking about scary guttural voices last week, and I was sort of speculating as to where that started. We got a message from Ollie and Jessamine, a.k.a. Oggs and Pod. Hi, Joe 90 and Buxton. A good friend of mine and brilliant musician, Justin K. Broderick, original founder of Napalm Death and now Jesus/Godflesh, was one of the first people to sing in that scary, demonic, crazed voice. It's widely considered that he actually invented it. I'm sure that's a controversial point of view, and we'll get loads of messages going, no, actually, it was Gary Grunty.
They won't be in that face. Voice, though.
Might be. Anyway, he says, hope
they're paying this voice. I think you'll find I invented that voice.
Thanks very much, Ollie and Jessamine. So, yeah, eggcorns. We got a few of these through this week. Here's one to kick things off from Paolo in London's Cruel Centre. He says, fella boys, whilst working at the Royal Festival Hall at the turn of the millennium, I had a bar manager who used an incredible array of language, a kind of grab bag of phrases that he never quite mastered nor understood. One day he asked me where I'd left the tubs of ice cream that we used to sell at the intervals. I said they were on the top level, in the fridge. He went all the way to the top floor to retrieve them. Only then did I realize I had the key to the fridge. He returned after about 5 minutes. So vast is that huge building, it takes ages to get around, and he was absolutely fuming. He shouted, "You deliberately sent me on a wild goof trek!" I now use that term exclusively in place of the original. It's so much better. The same manager also used to shout "Flaming Laura" whenever he was upset. "You've sent me on a wild goof trek,
Flaming Laura."
Oh, Flaming Laura.
He's brilliant. Here's one from a chap called Nick Cheese. I don't think his surname is Cheese. I think he just works in some sort of cheese-related business. A friend of mine recently said, when walking into our messy office, "Oh, looks like a bombsy tit."
What?
Looks like a bombsy tit. To which we all fell about laughing. He said that was what his mum always used to say about his bedroom. And then we got another email, slightly later, from Sean Buckley, which says, "Darlings..." Yeah, not going to read that. It calls us quite rude names. It says, "Throughout my childhood, my mum used to tell me that my room looked like a bomber's hit it. Then, when I was about 12, she said, 'Your room looks like a bomb has hit it.' And that was that. So maybe that's the same guy."
So he thought that there was an actual thing called a bomber's hit it.
Bomber's hit it, yes. And then the other one is bombsy tit. I don't know quite what's going on there, listeners. I'll leave you to figure that out.
"Your room looks like a bomber's hit it."
No, it's not. It's a bombsy tit, ma'am. I don't know why I read that in an Australian accent as well. A bombsy tit sounds like something they might have. I don't know, an old crashed aeroplane.
"Oh, mate, look at your bombsy tit. That's nice." Is that a new one? Here's a message from Jeremy, that is, a mailman from Black Squadron in Bristol. And he says, "Dear old Dirty Buckle and Jake Horn, whilst out walking with my girlfriend Tess the other day, we passed a man, at which point I said, 'Oh, I think that was Terry Nutkins.' At which point she asked me, 'The one from the Beatrix Potter books?' At realising what she'd said, she then laughed for 10 minutes. And then when she could catch her breath, she said, 'I mean Lord of the Rings. Love you, bye.'"
What? Terry Nutkins from...
So he says, "I think that was Terry Nutkins." And she goes, "What, the one from the Beatrix Potter books?" And then she goes, "Oh, no. I mean Lord of the Rings."
Yes. What's he called, Nutkins? There is a Nutkins character in... he's not called
Squirrel
Terry,
Nutkins.
Is he? Squirrel Nutkins.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is Squirrel
mistake.
Nutkins in Lord of the Rings?
Nah.
Yeah, you sure? It might be in one of those crowd scenes at the back.
He might be. Terry Nutkins might be in the back there, as far as I know. I've got a whole list of quickfire ones here. This is a nice little list that's been sent in by Matt. He's a bloke man. And Matt says, "A&J, over the years I've documented the spoonerisms, malapropisms and faux pas of a chap in my office. Here is a very brief selection. You've completely missed the wrong end of the stick. If push comes to crunch, I couldn't see the trees for looking. You need to make a stance. Don't jump your horses."
I like that one. That one could be good.
Yeah.
That could actually go into circulation.
It's time to put the foot to the metal.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get the ball moving. And we can't argue pedantics all day.
Ooh. Why not? I love arguing pedantics.
Oh, we can't argue pedantics all day, so don't jump your horses and get your foot to the metal. Thanks very much there. That's Matt. You got any more there, Jay Corn?
"I heard a cracking egg corn the other day whilst talking to my girlfriend. We were discussing the difficulties in getting a job when she said, 'I know, it's doggy dog out there,' as opposed to 'dog eat dog.' I thought this was hilarious and never planned to ever, ever, ever let her forget it.
Although
lots of love, Sam," a female man.
Female man.
From Brighton.
Nice. My favourite kind of man.
Noises, beeping noises.
We're getting lots of texts about the airborne toxic event.
Sure. What kind of theories are circulating there?
Stephen Chicken says it's definitely a mouth noise.
No.
You need to get a bit of nasal phlegminess onto it too, though. I'm also sure it's on the inhale, not the exhale. Therefore, I believe he's clearing his nose by sucking the smog down the back of his throat.
No. It's nothing like that. Can we have a quick listen?
It's one of the tracks that Lennon and McCartney truly wrote together, which is quite rare.
That would have to be a full-on raspberry, which would be a very immature thing to do during such a stately and important program.
Yeah.
I think we need... If you're a sound scientist... I know we have many sonic scientists listening to this show.
Sure.
Do a kind of Oliver Stone stroke John Travolta in Blowout, suggests Gary. Do an analysis of it and see if you can figure out what it is. Slow it down, examine the waveform.
We were thinking,
compare it to other famous toxic events from history.
Sure. We were thinking possibly if they have leather seats in the studio and one of the guests, maybe Goodall's got his leather trousers on or his leather pants.
Yeah, well, we were picturing Gambo maybe in a kind of a faux leather flight jacket.
Yeah.
But we can find out. Well, we're going to find out what the seats are made of in that studio. This is a very important thing that's happening here. You know, somebody...
It's an important...
It's a very important programme.
Desert Island Discs, that's more or less the flagship show of the...
It's the founding stone of the BBC and someone has ridiculed it and compromised it. Therefore, they must be brought to justice and we are relying on you, our listenership, to help us get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Quite literally.
Yeah, what? And the other day, I was out in the jardin de Max Factor.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a lot of, nettles.
They're a problem in the countryside, in the English countryside.
Man.
They're very prolific.
They are prolific as all heckins. And it only takes a couple of weeks for them to decide that it's time for them to go all prolific on your ass. Mm. You know, literally, 1 week, there'll be nothing there, and the winter will be finally put to bed, and the spring comes around, and then suddenly it gets a tiny bit warmer. Nettles! Everywhere.
Yes. They're the scourge, aren't they? They're there to teach children that nature is dangerous.
What the heck is the point of the nettle?
That, just what I said.
To teach children that nature is dangerous.
Yeah, they're sort of harmless.
That's what you're saying, is it?
Yeah, they're kind of... It's like the it's like the thin end of the lethal nature wedge.
Right, okay, okay.
You know Herzog could do a documentary on nettles.
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 The evil, the most evil
They want
plant.
To kill you.
They revel in murder. I was trying to clear away... And I got obsessed with the idea of combating
murder.
I got obsessed with the idea of combating the nettle scourge, right?
Because right, trying to clean them out.
Yeah, there was one area that's totally. We had it as a nice little bonfire area, mm-hmm. and we had some big logs that were out there, like half
I bet you did.
Logs, and we were sat out there just a few weeks ago. Me and my brother and my dad were sat out there like mountain men. Sharing,
the nettles hated you doing that,
sharing tall tales.
They were lurking in the weeds, watching you.
Yeah.
Whispering. As soon as you went indoors, they started growing up.
Now they're like waist height now. I mean, they're absolutely
sure.
huge.
They're furious with
the
you.
The thing about the nettles is that if you have the protective clothing
yes.
and the correct gloves, you can uproot them very satisfyingly easily. Like you pop them out and all their roots come out and you're like, yeah.
They have poisonous hairs.
They do have
They're like a man
hairs.
With a... They're like a hirsute man. With poisonous hairs.
Don't you mean hirsute?
Oh, damn it. I got it so wrong, I got it right.
They are hirsute. They're deadly hirsute. How do they work? Let's see. They have hollow stinging hairs. Called trichomes.
Trichomes, that's right.
On their leaves and stems, which act like hypodermic needles.
Oh, steady on.
That inject histamine and other chemicals that produce a stinging sensation.
They act like hypodermic needles. They're suggesting they penetrate the skin.
Correct.
I thought they just brushed against it.
No, penetrate skin.
Do they?
Like hypodermic needle.
Really?
Yes, they go into your skin.
OMG.
And that is why, you know, and here's some top tips for what to do. I went and searched for how to avoid being stung by a nettle or dealing with nettle stings.
Well done.
First top tip on WikiHow was move away from the nettles.
Yes.
To a nearby area to prevent being stung again. What's that? Don't go so close to the nettles.
My technique is usually to press my face into the nettle.
Well, that's why I've been going, well, yeah, exactly. I've been wandering around with my shorts on. Don't do that. Go to somewhere where there are no nettles.
Good tip.
A more practical tip, pour a small amount of water on the ground, only enough to create mud, and apply the mud to the sting.
I thought you were going to say scorn. Pour a small amount of scorn on the nettles.
I don't think scorn works on nettles.
Really?
It's one of the only things that scorn doesn't actually have any
What was the piece
on.
Of advice then? Pour some
water on the ground to create some mud, and then apply mud to the sting. Wait for it to dry, then brush it off.
Hopefully, What about this?
It will remove the stingers with it.
This seems very long-winded. I thought, isn't there a thing where if you just grab a nettle with confidence
yes.
and gusto, it won't sting you? You psych the nettle out.
Yeah, well, presumably, if we are thinking of it in terms of these little hypodermic needles, presumably you're sort of deflecting them. You're not allowing them to penetrate your skin.
If you meet them with equal and greater force,
yes.
you bend the needle.
You're just sort of bashing the needle, right. Mm. Final top tip, apply adhesive tape to the infected area, then remove. Most of the stinging hairs will be pulled out of the skin. It's all about removing these stingers.
The nettle, they stay in your skin.
They stay in the skin. Who knew?
Who knew?
Who knew?
Who the heck knew? Hey, wasn't I told about the stingers in the skin? Why now?
So the other day I was combating the net owls, and I had a lot of protective gear on, but I got so obsessed with winning that I started getting stung quite badly, more and more and more, and then I was just, I don't care, I'm going to kill you hecking nettles! And I went in there, and in the end I came out and my arms were just ballooned, red, covered in horrible sort of pockmarked stings.
Were your arms bare? Were they nude?
A little bit, yeah.
Oh, that was a mistake, mate.
I put gobbles.
But what about dock leaves? We should mention dock leaves as well. Because nature slaps and strokes.
Exactly.
It slaps you with the stingers and then it strokes you with the dock leaves. And they always grow nearby.
It's so weird.
It's very balanced. Isn't it?
What's nature thinking?
What is nature thinking?
Just to give you a little smack and then, yeah, oh, there's a dock leaf there, stop complaining. I've done a little song about nettles.
Have you?
Yeah, in the style of my, well, I've done it.
You're not going to play it, are you?
Yeah, it's so short.
You've bought it in?
It's short. I do this thing, Country Man, and which is on, I've given it a plug before on the show, hope you don't mind if I do again. It's on the BBC's comedy website and sometimes my YouTube channel. Subscribe, why not? It's all right, it's not a money-making venture, I'm not violating any rules. This is my song about nettles.
Nettles, nettles, painful plot, so close to my heart. Nettles, like a band for police, the sting is an integral part. Nettles, also like a band for police, Stuart Copeland is their drummers. Nettles, also like a band for police, they're blooming using Andy Summers. Nettles, also like a band for police, they recently reformed and went to touring. Nettles, but unlike a band for police, nobody will pay to see the nettles.
I didn't say it was good.
It was good. It was very good.
I just said it was about nettles.
Wow.
Right. So I think we're going to fire off the Text the Nation jingle and just very briefly set out our stall. Why the heck not?
Text the Nation. Text, text, text. Text the Nation.
What if I don't want to?
Text the Nation.
But I'm using email. Is that a problem?
It doesn't matter. Text.
So you boiled it down there to what there?
Nature war.
Nature war. So times when you go for a wonderful walk or a ramble or a frolic in nature, mm-hmm. in God's garden, with a big smile on your face, you go gamboling and skipping into some natural area and then something rears its ugly head to tell you to get out.
Nature pops up and slaps you right in the fizz off.
Not looking for nasty things. Wow. Yes, we are.
Yeah, a little bit.
So what else?
It doesn't have to be you've gone out rambling. It's just any kind of skirmish that you've had with nature. You know? Because do you ever listen to Gardener's Question Time?
Sometimes a little bit.
Only when things go wrong. That's how I listen to it. Sometimes you're trapped with it. I mean, obviously I know it's a great show.
It's a great show, no disrespect. But we're not mutually interested in gardening that much. I listen to it long enough to realise what it is.
It's not my preferred show. I'm not so mad keen a gardener that I really absolutely have to listen to it. So when it comes on and there's absolutely nothing else on and it's...
But it's a fantastic show and we wouldn't want to undermine
obviously,
its legacy.
Never want to undermine the legacy of the Gardener's Question Time. But oh boy, it goes on and on and on. And my favourite part of it, though, when I start perking up and thinking, hey, this is a bit more fun, is when people have questions about unruly plants and when the roots go crazy and go underneath people's fences and stuff. And how do I uproot
this? When nature fights back.
You know, when nature goes absolutely nuts on your ass.
Yeah. That's good subject. Nature war.
Yeah, nature war.
Get those messages coming in.
The lizard wakes up in a futuristic prison. The lizard has seen Star Trek and he knows which spaceship he's in. Reflected in the mirror, a disturbing furry vision. To his horror, he realizes he's turned into Mr. Neelix. Mr. Neelix, Mr. Neelix. Oh no, 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 no. He's turned into Mr. Neelix. Captain Catherine Janeway has reprogrammed his DNA. The holographic doctor's messing with his double helix.
Wow, we thought it was gone forever, but it came back.
Well, it was the last studio show of our current run this week, and I saw this message from Peter Boyle. He's a male humanoid and Black Squadron veteran. Dear doctors, he says, I've been waiting and waiting and waiting for a new instalment of the Wii Stick saga. Since none has been forthcoming, I'm hereby submitting the following lyrics. As you'll see, I've followed through on a couple of ideas suggested by Dr. Buckles himself in previous episodes. That's right, I'm busting out the Trek references. The tale resumes with our hero regaining consciousness in the brig of the USS Voyager. And from that point on, he has his DNA scrambled by the holographic doctor. For Voyager fans, you'll know the guy I'm talking about, played by Robert Picardo, who I saw in an episode of Frasier the other day. Fun facts abounding here. They are coming out of my mind at 2,000 miles an hour. So the doctor scrambles the lizard's genes. His DNA sequence is resequenced, and so he turns into Mr. Neelix. Who's one of the most annoying space ponces in the entire galaxy. And of course, the entire ship is ruled over by the ludicrous lady grip of Catherine Janeway. What was that?
I don't know. It's just very involved. I mean, I thought this was going to wrap up the Wii Sticks, but it seems to have opened a whole can of boring sci-fi nerd worms. Hey, that's not true. I love sci-fi.
Yeah, so do I.
I love worms.
Although Star Trek Voyager was not a place that I wanted to spend a great deal of time.
Is that it? Is G6 done? Did that reach any kind of conclusion?
Yeah, man. It's out in space. It's out in the cosmos now. There's nothing we can do about it. Nothing we can talk about.
It's a fictional universe anyway. Like, what possible power have we got over
Listen,
that?
Once the lizard got on to Voyager, he joined them, being catapulted into the 11th quadrant or wherever the heck they are. And it's going to take him ages to get back. Absolutely ages. So I don't know when we're going to see
the lizard. What if somebody sent in an amazing thing that still obeyed the rhyming laws of the lizard and also continued the story?
Yep, you never know. I mean, I thought Peter Boyle was sufficiently impressive there. He had it all done for me. Sometimes I have to fiddle with the scanning of people's lyrics.
You've got to make zero work for Buckley's.
You know, and Peter had done all the work. He had capitalized the parts of the lyrics where the stress should fall. It was just a beautiful job.
Peter.
Oh, Peter.
I love you.
Peter.
Oh, Peter.
Peter Boyle.
You are so clever.
What's your...
I don't know. Back to the podcast.
Here we go.
Traveling tales, tales of traveling on the train or an automobile or an aeroplane. I want to know what your traveling tales.
All aboard the Skylark!
Here is a message from Peter from Bournemouth. Actually, no, sorry. It is Stephen Paul Shepherdson. I'll get to you later, Peter. He says, Dear Bucks Adamanton and Joe Corjonish. He's done a bit of spoonerizing. I was recently on an aeroplane with my lovely wife, reluctantly returning home from a wonderful holiday. I'd been given an aisle seat, which was fine by me. I thought I could still glance across out of the window and watch the clouds float by. However, every time I turned my head, the man next to me was leaning over with his nose pressed against the little window, totally obscuring it. All I could see was the large lump of Brill cream congealed on the back portion of his hair. At the time, this infuriated me, as the little joy a flight has to offer was totally lost. Now, was he being selfish, or does the owner of the window seat automatically have full window rights? What are your valued opinions?
So,
Stephen
is saying that this person, the passenger next to him, blocked the window for the whole journey.
Yeah, the window seat and his face was mashed right up against it, staring down at the clouds there.
Really?
So what do you do about that? Is that on? Are you within your rights to say, excuse me, could I have a little bit of window time? I mean, I know I'm on the aisle, but still.
It depends if the captain announces that there's an extraordinary view.
Which sometimes they do.
Ladies and gentlemen, you might like to know that we're flying over the Grand Canyon, a spectacular view of the Grand Canyon outside the right-hand windows of the plane. Immediately everybody jumps up. The plane tips to the right because all the weight's gone over to the right.
Go right into the Grand
Canyon. That happened when I was on the plane the other week.
Did it?
Yeah. And I was very good. I sat back. I had a little look. Then I sat back in my seat and let everyone else peer.
Yeah, that's nice.
You've got to share the view.
Sure.
But I think maybe that man was having psychological problems if he spent the entire flight staring at clouds. And I think that, who is it, Steve?
Steve.
Should be a little more empathic towards this person's mental state. Because Steve is on the aisle, am I right?
Yeah.
So he has access to the lavvy. He has first dibs on the fun trolley.
It shouldn't ruin your entire flight if you can't look out the window.
It shouldn't.
I mean, maybe the guy as well was staring at some kind of gremlin ripping out engines
exactly
on the wing.
Yeah,
that could have been
Twilight
happening.
Zone style.
So yeah, I think if you haven't got the window seat, tough luck buster. All right,
decision made. It's gone against the correspondent for once.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Tough love. Here's a message we got from Oh, this is very long, but it's quite good. Rob Ryan. Dear Adam and Joe, for my birthday, my wife Lorna bought me a pair of these really expensive noise-reducing headphones. I was making a journey from London to Leeds in first class, thinking to myself I'd have a nice time doing stuff on my laptop, listening to some music with my cool new headphones.
Doesn't get better than that.
So far, so good. I was really enjoying the coffee and biscuits when I felt that I might possibly need to fart. Now, I have to explain to listeners that this is quite a fart-based piece of correspondence, so if you find that unsettling or unclean, you might like to look away. There will be quite detailed mention of farting coming up. To continue the letter.
Airborne toxic event is the proper technical
term. I'll use that. At this point, I should explain that I'm 48 years old, and since hitting 40, my need to unleash airborne toxic events has reached endemic proportions. I had no idea that my middle-aged years would be so gassy. Basically, I fart all day long. Anyway, the seat was nice and soft for good sound absorption, so I thought I might just ease a little silent one out and get away with it. Success! 20 minutes later, the need came again. Could I risk it twice? I did. I succeeded. The journey continued pretty much in this vein, farting silently every 10 minutes, until about 5 minutes from reaching my destination, I started packing my stuff away, took off my headphones. Just before we reached the station, I felt the need to do it again. No problem, I thought. These luxuriously soft first-class leather seats are perfectly designed to muffle any rear-end noises. And adopting the same technique again, I very gently released a toxic event. The rasping noise that issued was deafening. I'd forgotten I was wearing my noise-excluding headphones. I'd been letting off explosive guffs all the way from London to Yorkshire whilst merrily grooving and nodding along to my music. Classy, my fellow passengers looked up at me with a contempt reserved only for the type of imposter who thinks that he can travel first class and fart continuously throughout a two-hour journey.
What a monster.
Yours, Rob Ryan.
Rob, sort your life out.
We've all been there. Have we?
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't. A little bit. But you've been there. I mean, I may have been there on a plane.
Yeah.
But I, fingers crossed, the noises on, the noise of the air system on a plane and everyone's
absolutely
got their headphones on.
Oh, you can go for
but
your life with
chilling.
Impunity.
That's chilling.
That is chilling. Similar thing happened to me the other day when I was riding in what I thought was an empty carriage.
Mm.
And I had a luxuriant, explosive, toxic event.
Mm.
And looked behind me when I got up to leave, and there was a lady sat right behind
me. A lady being
me.
Sick into her handbag.
Sat right behind me in the thing, looking at me with a revulsion.
Thank you, Rob Ryan. He also says, P.S., my favourite part of the show is when you talk Australian.
Mate.
I love that, mate. I think he's the only one.
I've got a special so treat for you now then,
for
mate.
You, Rob.
Because this is from Tom Lemesure, a mailman from Winchester, but living in
John
Rio.
Lemesure.
Tom.
Let's pretend it's John.
Okay. Isn't that cool, though? He's living in Rio. He's probably in a carnival
salsa.
Right now. Salsa. Salsa. Dear Belt Buckle and Corn Cakes, this happened a few years ago. I was on a very busy commuter train heading out of London at the end of a long day at work. There was no air conditioning and a lot of people were having to stand as the train was so overcrowded. A middle-aged guy in a suit started writing a text on his phone, but he had the ketones on. So every single key press he made was accompanied by a beep sound. We were all putting up with it in what I think is probably a very English manner, i.e. hating him but too scared to say anything. Suddenly, an Australian guy said to him, "Hey, I've had a long day at work listening to phones and computers and people talking. Turn that phone off." Well, perhaps you can imagine the entire carriage went silent to see what would happen next. The guy with the phone stammered, okay, I'm just going to finish this message. But the Aussie guy said, "No! If I hear another noise from that phone, I'm going to take it and throw it out the window." There was a stunned silence. The aggressive Aussie had scared the bejesus out of everyone. He had broken the passive-aggressive rules. And in a very weird way, I ended up feeling almost sorry for the texter. "Okay, love you, bye," says Tom Lemesure. So the Aussie guy took control.
Wow.
How would you feel? Would you be pro-Aussie in that situation?
I don't really know, to be perfectly honest. I mean, in a danger situation where the Aussie maybe had to rescue somebody, then maybe you would... you know, that would be the right thing to do, to take command like that. But I don't know. I think that's crossing a line.
Is it?
Isn't it?
It's aggressive, isn't it?
I mean, he has authority because he's Australian.
Yeah.
A certain cultural superiority.
He's got a scarier voice.
Yes.
Mate, no!
Oh, mate, I'm going to fly to England to find Adam and Joe. They are my favourite pair of Brits. I love them.
since that they died. My plan is to get drunk with them and punch them in the tits.
I'm going to play some David Bowie shortly. And the other day, I was in a hardware store, and they had at the counter, sometimes hardware stores, for some reason, I don't know what it is about hardware stores, but they have selections of cheap, very, very cheap DVDs over there by the checkout. And sometimes they're quite good.
In hardware stores?
Yeah. I've noticed it. Maybe they have them in lots of places, but something about hardware stores, they just sort of think, oh, yeah, by the way, how about a DVD? And so they've got a really
weird... What
sort
of films?
Pretty mostly 10th-rate sort of
really
stuff. But in amongst the 10th-rate stuff was Labyrinth.
Well, that's because they stock films about tools.
Nice. They had an anniversary edition of Labyrinth, 2-disc set.
I only say that because of the codpiece.
Sure. And there was a documentary on this Labyrinth disc.
Oh, that's a great documentary. It's long.
Yeah.
It's sort of feature length, and it's got amazing interviews with David.
That's exactly right.
He is.
It's called Inside the Labyrinth, or Behind the Labyrinth, maybe?
It's called Up the Labyrinth.
Up the Labyrinth. Right, Up the Labyrinth, it's called. And I was reminded how much I love that film. I mean, we went to see it when it came out, didn't we, in the Odeon Leicester Square. And it was 1986, and we were very excited as Bowie fans.
It was 86.
And Jim Henson fans, and excited about the fact that Terry Jones had written the screenplay for Monty Python, of course. Now I'm trying to get my boys to watch the thing. It's too frightening for them.
It is a little bit scary.
Because it's too real and wonkaloid. It's all pre-CG.
Well, the sort of Wizard of Ozzy stuff, but at the beginning and end, the bookend stuff is quite peculiar.
Yeah.
The her home life is quite weird. And then when it all kicks off, when the lightning storm starts in her bedroom, it is pretty scary.
Yes. And let's remind people who haven't seen the film that this is basically about a young girl. What's the name of the actress? Jennifer Connelly.
Yeah, she's very beautiful. She was in... Once Upon a Time in America, just before that.
That's right. So this is more or less her second role, having been plucked from a life as a model, I think, to play this part of a young girl who's complaining about the fact that her baby brother is making so much noise. And she says, I wish the pixies would come and take you away.
Oh, shouldn't wish that.
And suddenly, just after she's wished that, there's a clap of thunder and an owl flies into the room and transforms into Jareth, the Goblin King, played by one David Bowie.
And so David is standing there, resplendent in his skin-tight jodhpurs, displaying for all the world his magnificent goblin pocket, and he is wearing a timelessly ludicrous hairpiece. I mean, it's got to be the worst kind of hairstyle ever created that will never, ever be fashionable, ever.
It's good. I mean, you're about to enter a world of crazy-haired Muppet puppets.
Yeah, that's true.
That haircut is your intro into that world.
And it looks... Well, how would you describe it? It's kind of a Lamal fountain of
It's
hair.
A sort of Strul, Peter, isn't it?
Yeah, it's poking at it. But it's not, because that's more, I think, of Edward Scissorhands when you see Strul, Peter. Mm. That's more Russell Brand-type...
Right.
Nest. But this is just ridiculous fright wig pointing up. Anyway, Bowie makes it look good, I think, as Jareth the Goblin King. But this behind-the-scenes thing is a treat. And Bowie is there being interviewed and taking it all very seriously. Here's a little clip of Bowie talking about how he became involved with the project.
He first brought me the concept on the 1983 tour that I did in America and asked me if I'd consider doing the part. And he showed me a copy of The Dark Crystal, which I found a fascinating piece of work. And I could see the potentiality of making that kind of movie with humans, with songs, with a more of a lighter comedy script.
Oh, David, excuse me.
Whoa, what is it? I've just come off stage. Why are you interrupting me?
I got an idea for a movie where there's puppets and a cut piece.
It sounds very interesting.
Are
yes.
you Frank Oz?
Yeah, these are very broad impressions of everybody.
It's like... puppets and a cut piece.
I'm interested. Come into my dressing room. Have you done anything before?
I was kind of involved in The Dark Crystal.
That's a fascinating piece of work.
I can absolutely see the potentiality in what you're talking about.
It's very provocative.
It's superlatively provocative, and I'd be very interested in becoming involvicised.
But it's a joyful documentary because you forget that it was such a hotbed of talent, that film. Apart from Bowie and Frank Oz himself, he's such a legendary figure. You've got the artist Ron Mueck. Do you know that guy? He makes these giant lifelike sculptures. Well, he plays around with scale. He had a very famous piece called Dead Dad, which was a sculpture that he made.
He was involved in Labyrinth.
He was. He was one of the puppeteers.
I didn't think he'd be old enough to do that. I thought he was a young chap.
He was very young when he was in Labyrinth. At that stage, he was a model maker, an Australian model maker who'd been involved.
An Australian model maker.
Right. And then he moved to the UK, and now he's, you know, known as a fine artist. He was in there. You've got George Lucas hanging around the set, of course, because he was exec producing that. You got Terry Jones in there. And there's, for Star Trek fans, Beverly Crusher's sister does the choreography.
But anyway, you're going to play a good record. Yeah. I had this on 12-inch before the film came out. I used to play this over and over again.
I mean, musically, it wasn't... I'm going to stick my neck out here. Hey, musically, period wasn't Bowie's strongest. Maybe, I'm saying. And I do like it. I love the sort of gospel feeling of it, and it reminds me of happy times.
In a magical forest sit a couple of gnomes. They're doing a podcast for trees and for stones.
The trees and the stones, listen on headphones.
But it's not just for stones or just for trees, though of course they're the big podcast fans. It's also for Pixies and Dinosaur Jr. and other reformed indie bands. But the number one fan is the Goblin King. His name is Jarrett. Listen close, you can hear him sing.
Was
I love Adam and Joe. Their theatricality is so superlative. I like listening with Brian Eno. But they never read my texts or made up jokes out, even though they're amusing, so what's that about? Anyway, was.
I like to change the lyrics of songs from time to time.
Lock the taskbar.
To make them refer to things I do. I call it appropriation, and as far as I'm aware, it isn't a crime. I wonder if it's something you do too.
Yes it is. I'd say that was my favourite Buckley's jingle.
You know, I was trying very hard to do something a little less aggressive and...
You did very well. It's beautiful. Very lovely singing.
Relaxing. Here's a message from Julia. She's aged 30 from Liverpool. She says, "Dear Count Buckula and Corn Dog, at work, when I am feeling particularly pressured to balance the many conflicting demands which are expected from a personal assistant, I like to sing, 'Stressed! Ah! I've got an ulcer the size of the universe!'"
What?
In the style,
I've got
of
a what of the size of the universe?
An ulcer. Ah. In the style of Flash Gordon by the Mighty Queen. I find that vocalising this doesn't help at all, but I still find myself singing it every single time.
I've got a bit of scorn to pour on that.
Go on then.
I mean, I think it's very easy. I mean, Flash, you could put any single syllable word into Flash.
Stress! Yeah, but the Couldn't word we? Stress is in, you know, it fits.
It's
it has
good,
the
good,
right
good,
kind
it's good,
of...
It's good, it's good, it's good. It's good. I mean, people were saying the same thing about one we had the other week. The guy that sang his name to the shaving advert,
Gillette.
The best a man can get. Yeah. So maybe I'm, you know, maybe I it's the pot calling the kettle black.
That calling the kettle back, don't you mean?
Yeah.
That was my wife's favourite. Mike Shinks, the best that Fran could
that's
get.
That's right. Here's one, what we got from Sinead and Hugh Kelly in London. Have you noticed how the tube announcements have started pointing out which side of the train the door will open? Which side of the train the door will open? That makes sense, yes.
Yeah.
This makes me and my husband start singing, "The doors will open on the left-hand side." The other passengers do tend to look at us a bit strangely, but this always amuses us no end.
What was that noise you made?
It was just like a sort of six-year-old
to help
laughing.
People.
Yeah, it's just a hint what you're supposed to do in response to that.
Cornballs.
Thanks, Sinead and Hugh Kelly.
Canned cornballs laughter.
I mean, that's public appropriation.
Yeah.
Is that sensible to do these things loudly in public, to sing these things?
Yes, joyful.
Joyful?
Yeah.
People might think you're a moron.
No. Everyone does pop-propriation. Everybody.
Everybody. Every, yeah.
Everybody. True. Dear Jojo and Buxtable, says Richard and Sarah, a male man and a female woman from Brighton, our daughter has just turned two and it's still and is still susceptible to the sorts of snots and sniffles that often loiter in toddler noses. Whenever my wife or I attempt to gently decongest said nose with a tissue, we literally cannot help but sing to the tune of Heatwave's Boogie Nights, "Bogey Nose. Ain't no doubt you are really snotty. Bogey Nose, come on now, got to get it cleaned up. Dance with the boogies, get down, dance with, because your bogey nose is always the best in town. You've got bogies in your bogey, bogey, bogey nose.
Bogey, bogey nights there. Bogey nights.
That's a good one there.
It's a good one.
I made up a song for my for Frank when he was very snotty. Mm. I had a original thing, which was...
You going to sing it to us?
Well, bogey nose, bogey nose, bogey nose. But it was a bit... Yeah, I don't really want to...
Backpedaling.
He's got a great big bogey up his nose.
It's too personal. It's just...
No one wants to hear that.
No, it's personal.
Oh, dear. Sorry, Frank.
Finally, here's one from Dermot. Which, now, this person was trying to trick me out with their name because it's spelt D-I-A-R-M-A-I-D. Diarmaid.
Diarmaid.
But I looked it up on the internet.
Nice.
And I know it's pronounced Dermot.
Good job, man.
I'm a man. I'm a male man in Galway, Ireland, in the 17 to 25 demographic. And I have a appropriation for you. When I walk into a room and the room is a bit chilly, I like to sing, "Cold, cold in here, wah, wah, wah."
Oh, like golden years.
Yes.
Nice.
Yes.
Cold, cold in here.
Wah, wah, wah. That's quite a good one.
Very good.
Yeah.
And finally, from me, we had quite a few of these. This is one that's very popular for pop-propriation. I'm talking about the track Physical by Olivia Newton-John.
I like that track. I've got it on 7.
Does that bear up well?
I haven't listened to it for a while.
It's got one of the...
20 years, perhaps.
It's got a sort of sick sexist video, I seem to recall.
Sick and sexist.
Sick and sexist.
It's just ladies working out. There's nothing sexist about
just,
being
I
a lady.
It was Olivia
working
out amongst a group of
very fat men.
Very overweight men,
That's weightist and sexist. Yes, you're right.
Exactly. It's disgraceful. Louise, a London girl, says, I'm listening to the podcast and the item on appropriation reminded me that the other day when getting ready to cycle on a gloomy day, I'd put on lots of high-vis clothes and lights. I started singing to the tune of Physical by Olivia Newton-John. Let's get visible, visible. I wanna get visible. Don't want to be invisible. Can you see my yellow coat? My yellow coat. Can you see my yellow coat? That turns into a kind of Heidi High thing at the end there, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it? It sounds like a sort of public information
film. I
want
a yellow coat. Can you see my yellow coat?
Who is that?
Peggy.
Is that Sue Pollard?
Yeah.
Text the Nation this week is all about nature war. Times when you think you are going to have a lovely time in God's garden, the benevolent world of green things. You frolic into it and find it biting you on your ass in a nasty manner. Here is one from Nick in Cumbria. I took my family for a nice Boxing Day walk to see some icicles that had been pictured in the local paper.
Good effort, mate.
The path to them turned out to be a treacherous sheet of ice. My three daughters were weeping in fear. Our pensioner friend Maggie slipped off the path onto a frozen river. She couldn't get back up until passing walkers equipped with boot spikes lashed together dog leads and hauled her out. They didn't look impressed by our sloppy shoes. I got it in the neck big style, but I told my wife, we've gained an anecdote.
Love you guys, Nick in Cumbria. I like stuff that turns horrific. I mean, that's good because no one was actually hurt, yeah, but it started out as a lovely little frolic and turned into a Kevin MacDonald style nightmare.
I'm impressed that he got the family out to see the icicles there. That would not have gone down well.
They were probably amazing.
Yeah.
Imagine the picture in the local paper.
I guess they would have made them look nice.
Yeah, they're all icicles. Nice and icy. Here's one from Rob in Croston in Lancashire. Sometimes when I'm walking or running along, I see an overhanging tree branch. I like to give it a high five. I'm high-fiving nature. Is it a bit OCD? Perhaps, but I love to do it. I also used to do this when riding my bike until one horrible day. On my route home from work, there was always a tempting branch which punctuated my journey home. Nowhere near the road, that would be dangerous. This was on the university campus. It was quite high, so I always had to stand up on my pedals to reach to connect with it. High five! On this occasion, all went textbook, but in the time it took me to put my hand back on the handlebars, my trouser cuff got caught on my chain and I lost my balance. I ended up with the bike on top of me, my foot through the spoke of the front wheel.
Yarg.
Luckily, I only grazed my arms and no one was around to laugh at me. But I don't tend to high-five trees on my bike anymore.
It's a shame no one saw that. He would have looked like a Wally.
It's tempting to grab a leaf, isn't it, when you pass an overhanging branch?
Oh, yeah, tear a bit of foliage off.
Yeah, or if you're passing a bush, to pluck a leaf off.
You don't
it between your fingers.
You don't go up to a person and pull out their hair.
Yes,
Why would you do it to a tree?
Here's another one.
Children love to do that. They love to damage foliage. You really have to explain.
Well, it grows back.
I know. It's very hard to explain to a child why it's a bad thing just to yank some foliage.
I think it depends on the number of leaves on the tree. I mean, if there's lots, then the leaf can spare it.
I'm going to make a film all about trees coming to pull your hair out.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't think trees should be allowed to give joy to a child?
Not that. They can do other things. They can hug
trees?
Them. Hug them.
Hug the tree. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Here's one for Joggle and Buxy.
Oh, yeah.
Who are they?
I don't know. They sound cool.
Whenever I was very young. Sort of a way to start a message.
Every time.
I remember going for a walk with my parents and their friends, who included a minister. I saw what I thought was a very nice stick, which I wanted for my stick collection.
I've got one.
I picked it up excitedly and was confused when it squished.
Oh!
Nature and I have never seen eye to eye since. Fight one last one.
That's like the joke, though, isn't it? What's brown and sticky?
Well, not really. Because it's not a stick. Stephen, a boy man from Dublin. I came home from work on Monday to notice the front door of my house was covered in caterpillars. My girlfriend would not let me get rid of them because she said they would turn into butterflies and it would be, open quotes, lovely, close quotes. Her teacher friend said it would be highly educational to bring them into class to show them turning into butterflies. The next day we got an email from her teacher friend to say that one had exploded into maggots and the others were dying.
Exploded into maggots.
Not the lesson she planned for her 7-year-olds. Yes. Maggots. What are these maggots? In that some of the children got maggots in their eyes and faces. And the others were dying. They're probably being sick while they were dying. Awful. Expected something lovely and got a hideous
explosion
of maggots and caterpillar vomit. The end.
Podcast. That is all there is of the podcast. It is all over.
There we have it, listeners.
Yeah, sorry
the
about
podcast.
That. So it's, you know, it's the best we could manage. It was
an immature program.
A little bit of an immature
juvenile
program.
After the program, we were greeted by a small team from the Radio Times who wanted to make a video of us asking us various Glastonbury-based questions.
You'll probably be able to see it online sometime this week.
Maybe not, because we were in such an immature mood by the time we came out of the show that every answer to their questions was very stupid.
It was.
So they probably won't use any of it.
Yeah, it was. I mean, there was a point, like, they started off, the ladies who were filming the interview, they started off sort of smiling and chuckling politely. By the end of it...
Well, the one on the camera laughed harder and harder. The one asking the questions laughed less and less.
And she was thinking, yeah, can you just answer the questions, please, you ridiculous ponces. So there you go. That might be up online for you to check out.
But talking of Glastonbury, don't forget, if you're going to the Glastonbury Festival next weekend, then you can come and hang out with us. And we very much hope you will. We'll be doing our show on Friday, Saturday and Sunday from Glastonbury at the normal time, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. And on the Saturday morning, if you are up early enough, come to the gate to the left of the pyramid stage and you will find me and Adam with microphones for half an hour communing with any members of our audience who are there. So please come down, behave yourselves, don't be naughty.
And it'd be cool to see everybody. If you check out our blog, you will see that James has put up a Brosnan visage, which if you wanted to, you could cut out, glue onto cardboard and attach to your face to make yourself particularly noticeable. Otherwise, if you're not into that kind of mask-wearing shenanigans, then you can just come and meet us at the gate.
Yeah, it would be nice to meet you. And let's have some communal Taffin shouting. I think that would be a fun thing to do, don't you?
Mm.
That would be very enjoyable. So, yeah, look forward to seeing you there, chaps. Take care. Have a wonderful week. We love you.
Thanks for listening.
Bye!
I tickled him. Oh, he's still going. Bye.
BBC Six Music Podcasts.
If you liked Adam and Joe, why not try Jarvis Cocker's Six Music Show, Sundays from 4.
Six Music. Six Music.
Why be any different? Why not stay the same? You learn to love the things you do. You've learned to love your name. Why be any different? He's just showing off. Just be Nicky Normal, and that'll be enough.
Adam and Joe
on Six Music.